you. Thank you. Welcome. Welcome. Welcome to the Mike Lazaridis Theater of Ideas here at Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics in Waterloo, Ontario, Canada. And welcome to this Perimeter's public lecture series. My name is Greg Dick. I'm the Director of Educational Outreach here at Perimeter, and it is a pleasure to welcome everyone here this evening, both those of you here in the live studio audience and also those of you watching online, either on Perimeter's website or on one of our many science communication colleagues' websites around the globe. The lecture itself will last approximately 1 hour and will be followed by a question and answer session. Now, for those of you watching online, we have a team of researchers behind their keyboards monitoring both the Twitter and the Facebook feeds. If you want to join that conversation, use hashtag PILive. And now, we have a special start to today's event, and I would like to introduce to you Minister Kirsty Duncan. As you may know, Canada now has a dedicated Minister of Science, the Honourable Kirsty Duncan, Member of Parliament from Etobicoke North, as well as a Minister with the Department of Innovation, Science, and Economic Development. Dr. Duncan is a medical geographer and was an Associate Professor of Health Studies at the University of Toronto and a Research Director at the former AIC Institute for Corporate Citizenship at the Rotman School of Management. Dr. Duncan has spent a day touring Waterloo Region, including a terrific exchange of ideas and insights here at Perimeter Institute. As a passionate advocate for science and scientific research in public policy, of the promotion of STEM subjects, and of the role of women and Aboriginal people in science, we have asked her to share her enthusiasm with you here this evening. So, Minister Duncan, thank you for your time here at Perimeter. And before your next activity, please allow us to thank you for your interest and support in all that we do. Minister Duncan.
Good evening, everyone. And Greg, thank you for that generous introduction. C'est un honneur d'être ici ce soir. Perimeter is a remarkable institute devoted to unlocking the mysteries of our universe. On behalf of the Government of Canada, I'd like to thank Neil Turok and the amazing team here at the Institute for hosting me today. And to all of you joining us in person and online for your support of science. When Prime Minister Trudeau asked me to take on the role of Canada's Science Minister, I was truly humbled because I believe it is a privilege to promote science, to celebrate our scientists, and to return science to its rightful place in government. An essential part of promoting science is providing researchers with opportunities to share their work with the public, as they do every month here in Perimeter's public lecture series. Tonight's speaker is Dr. Katie Rees, a world-leading astrophysicist studying the secrets of dark matter. Understanding this abundant but elusive matter, which is believed to make up the majority of the universe, is one of the greatest challenges facing modern science. In her recently published book, The Cosmic Cocktail, Dr. Rees describes this bold scientific quest, along with her experience as a woman in physics. It is worth noting that Dr. Rees is one of the first women to earn an undergraduate physics degree from Princeton University. And last year, Business Insider named her one of the 15 most amazing women in science today. Let me tell you about the extraordinary Dr. Katie Rees. She is the George E. Uhlenbeck Professor of Physics at the University of Michigan. She recently completed a term as the director of NORDITA, the Nordic Institute for Theoretical Physics in Sweden. Dr. Fries has also been a fellow or visiting professor at top centers around the world, including the Kavli Institute, MIT, CERN, the Max Planck Institute, and of course, right here at Perimeter. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Katie Fries. Merci.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for that wonderful introduction. So I'm here to tell you about the cosmic cocktail that comprises our universe. But before that, I just wanted to start with a picture of myself in Sweden. I spend half my time in Michigan and half my time in Sweden. And this is me at Nordida when I was directing the Nordic Institute for Theoretical Physics. On either side of me are yellow hospital buildings, well, former hospital buildings that are now physics buildings. So back in the day, this was way outside of the city of Stockholm, and that's where they put the infectious diseases. So I believe I was in leprosy, but the other buildings were typhoid and typhus, but it's okay. Leprosy is the one that can be cured by a bacteria. And now I have to tell you a funny story. I was just talking with your Minister of Science, Kirsty Duncan, out in the hallway, and we realized we had met at the Nobel ceremony in Stockholm. So that was, it was kind of remarkable, and we discussed our ball gowns at the first time we met. Anyhow, so every culture since antiquity has had its creation myths. Where do we come from? Who are we? What is out there? It's what makes us human beings. It's what makes us survive as a species. We ask these questions, we build tools, and so on. And the amazing thing in the last 100 years is that we have finally nailed it. We have more than a creation myth. We really do understand so much about the universe. We do have explanations for the early universe and its evolution. So how did this all begin? Well, it all started with the scientific breakthroughs of Albert Einstein in 1915. It was the theory of relativity that started all of this. And soon after he wrote down his theories, then other scientists thought, well, I can take those same equations and apply them to the universe as a whole. And when they did that, they realized, well, the universe could be expanding, it could be contracting, or it could be static. And then Einstein at the time said, well, he really liked the idea of a static universe because that's an additional symmetry, it looks the same at all times. And so there was a debate about, well, what actually does happen in the universe? Now, at that time, the theory was already so advanced and so clever, but observations were way behind. Back in 1915, people didn't realize that there's anything outside of our own galaxy. They thought every bright object up there is nearby. It's kind of astonishing to think in the last 100 years what we've learned way, way out there. So one of the major players on the observational side of things is Edwin Hubble, who first of all, he did prove that there are things outside of our galaxy. People called them island universes, but actually there are galaxies out there. And he also noticed a really important result by using telescopes outside of Pasadena, up in the Angeles Mountains, and he looked at the light from distant galaxies. And what he noticed is that the light waves that came to us were stretched compared to the light that was originally emitted from the galaxies. So it's as though, let's take this picture of a balloon, and you draw a wave on there, and you watch as you blow up the balloon, that wave stretches. And so if you have light from galaxies that's emitted with a certain wavelength that you know, and then you observe it here, and that wave has been stretched, well, then he concluded it must have been the expansion of the universe that did that, that made those waves, the wavelength, grow. So he came to the conclusion, observationally, the universe is expanding. That's not what Einstein wanted, but so Einstein had to abandon the idea of a static universe. So if I were to draw a simplistic picture, then I would have galaxies all expanding away from each other, and The thing is, no matter where you are in the universe, if you're at our galaxy, we see on the average all the other galaxies moving away from us. But if you put yourself at the center of a different galaxy, you would see the same thing. So no matter where you are, everything is moving apart from everything else. Now, that's not true locally. We have neighboring galaxies that we're merging with. But on the average, the universe is expanding and galaxies are moving apart. So we know so much now about the universe. We know that the start was roughly 14 billion years ago. And in the early hot days, the universe was a primordial soup. So you had all kinds of particles that were really densely packed together. It doesn't matter what they are, but they were really, really tightly packed together. And they were very hot and interacting with each other all the time. And so that was the very early universe. That was the time of the Big Bang. But then as time went on, these particles moved apart from one another because the universe is expanding and is cooling off as it does that. So that's what the idea of the Big Bang is. The universe started out hot and very densely packed. It's been expanding and cooling off ever since. One way to picture this would be with a piece of raisin bread. So if here you have a piece of raisin bread and the raisins are sort of models for galaxies, then, okay, I have to admit, I've never baked a piece of, actually, but they tell me that the dough rises and the raisins move apart from one another, and they're doing that simply because the underlying dough is expanding. So that's the model with space-time. But the one thing that fails with this analogy is that in the raisin bread, you do have a central point. But in the universe, we don't think that there is. So if I go back to that other picture of the galaxies, there's no special galaxy. There's no central point. So we're on one of these galaxies, but if you go to any other galaxy, everything would look more, on the average, would look the same. So in fact, a lot of people have an idea of the Big Bang that isn't exactly the way it's not really the right picture. So let's examine that. So let's look backwards in time. Take the universe today, and as you go backwards in time, things get closer and closer together. And eventually, everything in this room would connect to a single point. But what if the universe is infinite, which we think it might be? Well, then there'd be some things out at infinity, and no matter how far you contract everything, there'd still be something out at infinity. So there's no way you would contract everything to a single point. So the idea of the Big Bang is really a point in time. It's not a point in space. So in fact, if you're going to have the Big Bang be an explosion, which it really isn't, then please put one at every single point in the universe. Well, now let's turn to the question that I've been working on, which is, what is the universe made of? And here the answer is very surprising. Because if you take everything in our daily lives, you take your body and the air and the chairs and the walls and throw in the planets and stars and the cocktails we're going to have later, and all of that is made of atoms, but all of that atomic matter, all of that put together only adds up to 5% of the universe. So it's our job to figure out what the rest is. And so in fact, if I made a pie chart out of the whole thing, then the ordinary stuff that we know in our daily lives, that's only 5%. And the rest is 25% dark matter, and the rest is dark energy. So this is what we're trying to figure out. What is the dark side of the universe? And so, as the name of my book, I put the cosmic cocktail because it is a recipe for the cosmos. So, as I said, it's 25% dark matter. So if you had a 10-ounce drink, you'd put about 3 ounces of dark matter, 7 ounces of dark energy, and by the way, about a millionth of an ounce in supermassive black holes. So dark matter and black holes are really probably not the same thing. They might be, but probably not. And so you take all of that and then you shake it up in the early universe because everything's hot and interacting. So there's my cosmic cocktail. Well, how do we know about the existence of dark matter? To answer that question, let's start with what our galaxy, the Milky Way, looks like. So our galaxy does have, at the center, it has a very large black hole, which weighs about 4 million times as much as the Sun. And it's obviously, it's not yellow, it's just for the sake of the picture. And then as you come out from that, there are these, like a pinwheel, there's spiral arms of structure, and that's where all the stars are. Out here we have the sun along one of these arms. That's where pretty much all the stars are in the Milky Way. But now if we take this pinwheel and we look at it from the side, here it is, it's this flat thing that we call the disk. And moving out from the center about 25,000 light years, you get to the sun. And by the way, we're far enough away that we will never be sucked into that black hole in the middle. So don't worry about that. But all of that is only a tiny part of the total, because if I now take this disk, then what there's this big, giant, spherical thing around it that we call the halo of the galaxy, and that is made of dark matter. There's not a lot of stars in there. It doesn't give off a lot of light, which is why we call it dark matter. Well, how do we know about this dark matter? I'm going to leave dark matter for a second and turn to a totally different thing. We're going to look at the solar system, because the analogy of the solar system is it gives a good example for how we look for these dark objects. So what I've plotted here, you start out from the sun, and as you move right, you get to planets that are farther and farther away from the center of the solar system. And at the top is the fastest one. That's Mercury is moving the fastest. The next one, Venus, Earth, Mars, and so on. And they get slower as you move out. And I was supposed to remove Pluto, as you know, because it's not a planet anymore. But in my infinite wisdom, I managed to add a 10th planet instead. So. What it was, so you can, I don't know what you want to call it, Planet Nine or something, but anyway. So as things, as you move farther out away from the center of the solar system, you see that things are moving more slowly. And if you want to, no, I'm not going to have a lot of equations in the talk, but if the mass of the sun were four times as big, then everything would be moving twice as fast. It depends on how much mass there is pulling on this stuff and speeding it up. So the man who made these measurements of the planetary orbits was a man named Tycho Brahe. Now, he was a character. He lost his nose in a duel and then wore a gold and silver replacement. Ooh. Then there was a lot of question about how he died. So all along people had talked about, well, he went to a dinner with the king, and you're not supposed to get up before the king does. And by the way, I experienced this because when I was at the Nobel dinner, I actually went to the bathroom, and I was reprimanded because you're not supposed to get up before the king does. Well, okay, so it's actually true. He drank so much wine that he died from a burst bladder. And you would think this is insane until it all, you know, it's like, okay, so. But things heated up because there was a theory that he died of mercury poisoning by his student, Kepler, Johannes Kepler. So it's possible that those famous Kepler's laws were actually Brahe's laws, but Kepler killed him, okay? So not long ago, it was in the last, I don't know, 20 years ago, they dug up his body in Copenhagen, and they did tests on his mustache hairs to test this mercury poisoning theory, and there was no mercury poisoning. So I think it was the burst bladder. Anyhow, so he was the one who made the measurements of the planetary orbits. And now that we've talked about the rotation curves for the solar system, that's how fast things are moving as you move farther out from the center, I'm going to come now back to the dark matter question. I'm going to come back to galaxies. Starting at the center of the galaxy, as I move out some distance, I can watch stars or gas moving around the middle, and the speeds of those objects in orbit here are determined by how much mass there is in the middle. So if you have more mass in the middle, then these things move faster and faster. So that's how you can find out how much mass there has to be. And so there was a man in 1933, a scientist named Fritz Zwicky. He's a Swiss scientist working also in Caltech in the same telescopes that Edwin Hubble had been using. And what he noticed was when he looked at a cluster of galaxies, and that cluster had thousands of galaxies in there, that some of those galaxies were moving too rapidly. He couldn't understand that based on the stellar material that he saw. And so he speculated, well, there might be something else providing a gravitational pull and pulling on them. And that's the thing that is called dunkle Materie in German, or dark matter. So what that means is when the word dark in this case just means it doesn't shine, it doesn't give off light, you can't see it. There's some dark mass, something that is speeding up the rotation, the movements of things. So during my time in Sweden, what I discovered that 3 years earlier, there was a Swedish scientist, Knut Lundmark, who had made the same observations. He in fact got the mass of one of the neighboring big galaxies to us right, almost dead on by making these kinds of measurements. So. So that was actually a few years earlier. But in any case, the beginnings of the dark matter problems date to the 1930s. Oh, while I'm on the subject of Fritz Zwicky, I do have to tell a story here. So he wrote in his book that his colleagues were spherical bastards. Now, what did he mean by that? Well, that means, well, just like a sphere, no matter what direction you look from at your colleagues, They're still bastards. And so I can only say, you know, you didn't want to be his graduate student. another story. So I was doing a radio show in the Coast to Coast radio show in California. They usually talk about UFOs, but somebody called in and her name was Barbarella Zwicky. And well, first I just knew it was Barbarella, and I said, oh, hi, Barbarella. And it turns out it's his daughter. And to this day, she's bitter on her father's behalf that nobody listened to him about the existence of dark matter. So I only could say, well, we do now. But in any case, between 1930 and the 1970s, there was some progress in the area, but really it was the work of Vera Rubin in the 1970s with her collaborator, Kent Ford, that nailed it down that dark matter has to exist. So they found that the same kind of behavior that Zwicky had found in this one cluster, they found the same things true in every galaxy that they looked at. Every time they looked at a galaxy, there were things that were whizzing around way too rapidly and they couldn't explain it. And so this is the same picture that I showed you with the planets. So based on the stellar material, then as you move away from the center, things should have gotten slower and slower, but they didn't. They stayed really fast. And so if you add in this extra dark matter, then it explains, so these are really rapidly moving things, and so it's explained by having this dark matter in there. So that's where this picture comes from. It's from, and originally from these data, but by today, we have so many pieces of data that all point to the same thing. I don't think anybody would argue with the existence of dark matter anymore. Well, that's not true. There's probably people here working on alternatives. I better watch it, but anyway. No, I'm actually serious, but anyway. Okay, so another way that to look for dark matter is to use Einstein's lensing. So what Einstein pointed out is that mass bends light. For example, if I have some dark object here, and I've drawn a massive compact halo object, but it could be any kind of dark matter, anything, any mass, what it does if you have some distant star is it bends the light on its way to your telescope. Well, and it might bend the light in the on the other direction as well, on the other side. So if you didn't know better, you say, well, if I thought it was coming in a straight line, well, my star is over there. But then you'd notice, but there's another copy down there. And you'd also notice that they're kind of distorted looking. They're sheared, their shapes are funny. So you go look for that. So although the dark matter doesn't give off light itself, it messes with background light. And so you look for multiple images, sheared images, and people, oh yes, I had to show my more and more lensing of my graduate student, Alejandro Lopez. But so this is an example in real data taken by Hubble Space Telescope of exactly this kind of effect. So you have bright, distant galaxies that are lensed by intervening material, and you see here these different sheared images, and there's a whole lot of information in this picture, and I don't even remember exactly how many sheared images there are, but you get the basic idea. So from these images, you can then go and reconstruct how much mass there was in between the distant galaxy and you. And when you do that, you get pictures like this. Let me just say that this particular picture does not come from the image I just showed you, but it does come from other Hubble Space Telescope data. And so what I'm plotting here is the amount of mass at different locations in the sky. So where there's a peak, that means there's a lot of mass. And what you see is this is a cluster of galaxies, and these peaks are the galaxies. But look at this, in between these peaks, you have more dark matter. So there's dark matter even in between the galaxies inside the cluster. I'm going to show one more picture about dark matter, about how we know that it exists. And this is a famous object called the Bullitt Cluster. So what we think happened here is that there were two clusters of galaxies that collided with one another. Now, when they did that, shown in pink is what happened to the atomic material. So let's say you and I collide. Well, what's going to happen? We're not going to get very far. We get stuck. So that's what happened to the gas. It got stuck. And we see X-rays coming off. That's how we know where it is. But what about dark matter? Well, we think it's effectively collisionless in the sense that it doesn't have electromagnetic interactions, which we already know because it doesn't give off light. It also doesn't have strong interactions, which is what holds your nuclei together. And so, it feels gravity, but on the first go-round, when you have these collisions, the dark matter just keeps going, and you see these blue regions, again, seen by using the lensing to discover where is the matter. So this is kind of amazing. Oh, by the way, why is it called a Bullitt cluster? Because that's supposed to look like a bullet. But what's amazing about this particular image is that you have a clear distinction between the way ordinary matter behaves and the way the dark matter does, because the dark matter just keeps going. Eventually, there is gravity in there, and the gravity will pull the dark matter back, but that'll take some time for these two clusters to really merge together to one single object. Okay, so we have a problem. We know it's there. Most of the mass, more than 95% of the mass in clusters and galaxies, is made of some unknown dark component. It's made of dark matter. I also want to tell you another interesting thing about it, which is that without dark matter, we would not be able to exist. So I've got a few slides taken from computer simulations of the formation of galaxies. And the way that works is that in the early universe, all of matter was pretty much uniformly distributed, except there were some regions that might have a little extra mass in there, and then those regions that had extra mass would pull in more mass, and that region would grow, and become a galaxy, whereas the neighboring region had less stuff in it, and it would become more and more empty and become a void. So if we go back to the early universe, these bright blue objects are meant to represent dark matter, so they're not stars, it's the dark matter just shown in blue. And in this computer simulation, you start with things almost uniformly distributed, but then as time goes on, you're going to watch that dark matter clump. So here we go, as time goes on, until we reach today. And this is what the computer simulation predicts the very largest structures in our universe should look like, these long strands of structure. And it's at the intersection of the strands that you would find the galaxies. And this picture is a very good match to the actual universe today. So you have galaxies that merge, that are together inside clusters, inside bigger objects, and the largest ones are these long filaments of structure. So I mentioned that without dark matter, we wouldn't be able to exist, and what I mean by that is this whole picture of galaxy formation only works because we have dark matter. Back in the early universe, if you had atoms and they were trying to collect together to make galaxies, the problem is that they are talking to particles of light, photons, and the photons just stream out and pull out any clustering of matter. They destroy the clustering. But dark matter, as we said, it doesn't give off light, it doesn't feel light, it has nothing to do with photons. It can collapse. It makes structures first. And then atoms fall along with the dark matter structures that formed initially. So we need dark matter to exist. Okay, so now I've argued for how we know about this stuff, the dark matter in the universe, and that leaves us, of course, to trying to figure out what the heck is it. So the first thing that people tried was rocks, hot gas, neutral hydrogen, all kinds of ideas people had, but immediately they were ruled out because they had some kind of observational consequence that just wasn't there. So that didn't work. So then in the last 15 years, there were still two competing theories. One was, well, I might as well make the joke right away. Okay, there were the massive compact halo objects, machos. And then, so these are made of ordinary atoms, okay? And then there were more exotic particles, which included the WIMPs. So in the battle between the machos and the wimps, I actually worked on both sides of this story. And the bottom line is that it turns out it cannot be the machos. So these things could have been that, okay, there's not a lot of bright stars, but what if there were a lot of faint stars or substellar objects and your telescopes just hasn't found them? Well, it turns out that they're not there. It can't be. So it's still possible that some of the stellar remnants, these are the things when stars run out of fuel, they collapse, they become very dense objects. The sun will someday become a white dwarf. These very dense objects, there could still be some of those. In fact, 15% of the galaxy could be made of white dwarfs. So there's still, that's not nothing, but it still doesn't solve the problem. So atomic dark matter just is not enough. Okay, I have nothing further to say on this point. Where are you? Anyway. Okay, so we think that dark matter is some kind of elementary particle. And when I say new, I just mean as in we haven't figured out what it is yet. So not neutrons, not protons, something else. And there are a lot of candidates. So the one that would have been really nice is neutrinos, because neutrinos exist. In fact, Art McDonald is a board member of Perimeter Institute, and he just got the Nobel Prize with the party I got to go to, along with your Minister of Science. Anyway, so so neutrinos would have been great. We know they exist. But the problem is, they're too light. So Art McDonald was instrumental in measuring the mass, and the answer is they make up 0.5% of the universe. They just cannot solve the dark matter problem. So then people have looked at a lot of other interesting ideas, and the one that I'm going to focus on today is the one that I think has the best motivation and the best chance of being the right answer. So let me tell you about WIMPs. So this stands for Weakly Interacting Massive Particles. And billions of these would be going through your body every day, but they're not bowling you over because, as I've said, they don't have a lot of interaction. In fact, other than gravity, the only thing that they would feel is the weak force, which is responsible for some types of radioactivity. So we're going to make the postulate, well, there's some new particle, it feels gravity and it feels the weak force, and that's it, no other force. So that's what weakly interacting means in the name. And then as far as how much they weigh, they're something like 100 times as much as a proton. Well, why do we think these are such a wonderful possibility for dark matter? There's two reasons for that. The first one is they are their own antiparticles. And so if we go back in the early universe, when everything was hot and interacting, we can compute how many there was of every different type of particle in the universe. And we can observe how much annihilation is going on between the different WIMP particles. And eventually, as the universe becomes dilute enough, that annihilation process stops. And instead, you can figure out how many WIMPs are left today in today's universe, and the answer turns out to be about right. You get about 25% of the universe in the form of dark matter, where the only ingredient in that number came from having weak interactions for how they annihilate with each other. So that's one reason that people call that the WIMP miracle, that one reason that we like WIMPs as dark matter. And the other one is that you don't have to manufacture WIMPs out of nowhere. Instead, they're already existing in particle theories that were invented for reasons that really have nothing to do with dark matter. So you have a theory that's there for other reasons, and it automatically gives you WIMPs. And one example of that is called supersymmetry. This is an important extension of our standard model of particle physics, the standard model being complete now that we have the Higgs boson. So for every one of the standard particles, then you'd have a new partner, a supersymmetric partner. And the lightest of those supersymmetric partners, that could be a WIMP. That could be the dark matter. Well, that's all well and good. We have well-motivated particles, but nature doesn't necessarily do what you want it to, so we have to go and figure out, is this idea right? So there's three different approaches to doing that. And in this, this is really the same diagram drawn in three different directions. So one way to test this is to create wimps. So you would have two protons colliding and you'd make wimps. That's one thing you can do. So that we have three different approaches, and I'm actually going to talk about all three of them, so let me just go on and do that. I do want to say it's exciting times, because we made these proposals actually more than 20 years ago, but we think we're really on the edge of discovery. So this first way to search for WIMPs is using the particle accelerators, the Large Hadron Collider at CERN in Geneva. And so what you have here is a ring that's 17 miles around, and there are two proton beams traveling in opposite directions. And when they collide, that's where you put your detector, and that's where you study to see what happens. And if your protons are moving fast enough, they're moving very, very close to the speed of light, it's possible you could create dark matter. So I just wanted to show some pictures, because these beams are underground, so this is an underground beam pipe. And this is a picture of one of these detectors that's looking for the dark matter and at the Large Hadron Collider. And so this in particular is a picture of Fabiola Giannotti and the ATLAS detector, and she's actually now the director general of the entire CERN facility. Just to show you, this is a person. So just to show you how big this thing is, so one of these detectors, it takes thousands of scientists and technical people and computer scientists, and lots of stories I could tell, but anyway. So this is the other big detector, the CMS detector during construction. So here's an actual, this is a real collision that happened at the Large Hadron Collider. You had two protons that came in, and then they created something, and what you do is you look, your detector checks as the particles move out, what is the decay chain of what you produced, and then you reconstruct what you started from, and this one is a real Higgs boson. This is one of the ones where they discovered the Higgs, with these green things are the photons that are coming out. Anyway, so why did people build the LHC? Well, the first thing they wanted to do was discover the Higgs boson, and there it is at 125 times the mass of the proton, so that was... And within the same year, these guys, Peter Higgs and François Englert, got the Nobel Prize for that discovery. And then you can ask, okay, what's the second major thing that people wanted to find with this Large Hadron Collider? Of course, you want to discover new uncertain physics, and there are hints of that. But the other major goal was, from the beginning, was the discovery of supersymmetry and the discovery of dark matter. And I did want to, I'll put this up briefly, the Higgs boson is not the dark matter. The Higgs boson only lasts 10 to the minus 22 seconds. That's not a stable particle, which is what you need to make a galaxy, okay? So what you do is in these proton collisions, let's say some supersymmetric particle comes out and it goes through a chain and da-da-da, and eventually there's dark matter in there. And the dark matter would actually show up as missing energy. And you'd reconstruct everything and you'd figure out that you had discovered something new. Okay, so far that hasn't happened, but we hope it's coming. In fact, the detector is turned on now at twice the original energy, and there are some interesting hints of uncertain new physics. It's very exciting. Then the second way to look for these particles is to build actual experiments that are sitting there waiting for all these WIMPs in the galaxy. I said there's a billion going through your body every second. If you build the right detector, it'll notice that it got hit by a WIMP. But it's very difficult. So here I have this picture of some nucleus, a WIMP hits it. The nucleus heats up by a tiny, tiny amount. And you have to detect that somehow. And the problem is that the count rate is less than one count per kilogram of detector per day. But in the meantime, there's all kinds of other things coming around that could hit your nucleus instead. So what you have to do, I'll get back to that in a second. Let me tell you how I got into this. Speaking of cocktails, I was at a winter school in Jerusalem, and this man knew where to go for New Year's. So we started talking about science. Andrzej Drukiej is Polish, but he speaks English, French, German, and Polish, unfortunately, all at the same time. So But it was a pretty good New Year's party, and not only for the party itself, but also because we started talking about science, and that really affected my life actually, because he told me about work he'd been doing on ideas for neutrino detection. And well, it turns out the same tools you use for neutrino detection, that is one type of weakly interacting particle. Well, WIMPs are the other type. And so he ended up coming I was a postdoctoral fellow at Harvard, and he came there and we worked on some papers together. In fact, this is with David Spergel, our collaborator, and he was the one he figured out, okay, if there's gonna be WIMPs in the halo of the galaxy, how many there are moving, how fast, and so on. He put that in there, and then I was calculating the particle physics of these interactions. And we figured out that figured out how much the count rate could be in detectors, and the experimentalists decided, yeah, we can do that. And so they started building detectors. And by the way, this is, you have to go underground, because this is what I started saying earlier, that what you're competing with are other things that are also going to hit your nucleus. But if you go deep enough underground in these mines, and that's where this one's in South Dakota, there's actually an experiment in there now taking data, it's called LUX, then a lot of stuff is not going to get through the Earth. It's never going to make it to the mine. So you're removing most of your competing signals by doing that. And this is the worldwide effort that's going on now. So here we have all over the world. It's underground detectors, either underground mines or underneath mountains, and people are looking. And I wanted to mention something about one of them. This is in the Grand Sasso Tunnel. It's outside of Rome, and frankly, I'd rather be working there than in the mine in South Dakota, but anyway. So at this point, there are claims of detection, and the question is, has something already been discovered, or what's going on? And so in this original paper that we wrote, we noticed something called annual modulation, and that is this experiment in the Grand Sasso Tunnel that I mentioned. It's called DAMA. They see exactly what we predicted, which is that as the Earth moves around the Sun, the count rate should go up and down. And these guys have 10 years of cycles that exactly go up and down, with the peak in June, the minimum in December. It's really weird, and there's no alternate explanation. So that's great. Have they discovered WIMPs? Well, there's a couple of problems. First of all, they won't let anybody look at the data, so that makes people wonder what's going on. And in terms of personalities, just to give you an idea, so this is Juan Colliar is the leader of one of the experiments, and Rita Bernabe is the leader of the DAMA experiment, Eleanor Aprile of the Xenon experiment. And Juan, as Juan once said to me, I'm a Spaniard caught between two Italian women. So there's a lot of very strong personalities in this business. So it's actually a lot of fun. And but the other problem with DAMA is that it's very confusing, because other experiments do not see anything. So how do you reconcile these positive results from DAMA with the negative results from the other experiments? And we don't really know what's going on there, because it's like comparing apples and oranges. So the different experiments are made of different materials. If you want to compare them, you have to assume something about the interaction, such as if you assume it scales with the atomic mass squared, then I can make this plot, where DAMA means you have to be in the yellow regions, but these experiments put you below those curves. And anyway, I don't know how to plot them on the same curve unless I make a lot of assumptions. So we don't really know what's going on with this DAMA experiment, but we do have a good time discussing it. this meeting just happened 2 weeks ago. And as my friend who's the leader of the LUX experiment, Rick Gaskell, he said, you know, Katie, we can't keep upping the ante every 2 years, because, I don't know, it's just a better party every 2 years. So, but what we can do is, well, not me, but the different experimental groups, is take the same material as DAMA and go put it somewhere else. So there's two groups doing that. One of them is called DMICE. This is Reina Murayama is leading this. All right, so here is the surface of the ice at the South Pole. Well, close to it anyway. And then deep down here, you've got these strings of detectors. And just to put it in perspective, there's the Eiffel Tower, okay? So you have these way, way deep underneath the ice, you have detectors. And the original, the goal of these detectors is actually to look for neutrinos. But piggybacking off of that, you can put the same crystals that Dama uses and stick them down there. So that's a group that is looking for that. Yeah, she doesn't know this. I just wrote a promotion letter for her for Yale, but she'll get it anyway. Oh, I shouldn't tell you guys this, but anyway. So I, unfortunately, as a mirror theorist, all I get from the South Pole are stupid postcards. I don't get to go down there. And there's another experiment called SABER. There's a guy at Princeton who's going to go and test this. And so between these two groups, I think we'll have an answer as to whether Dama really found it or found the answer or not. That's exciting. Okay, so in the future, the next thing you want to do is to figure out what direction the WIMPs moved in. You have to do something radically different. And so this is our latest nutty idea. This is my also with André Druckier. I should have listed my collaborators on this. The same Polish guy, along with Charles Cantor, George Church, a lot of the great biologists are participating in this. Takashi Sano. So what we have here is a plane of gold with DNA hanging down. So isn't this fun? So the WIMPs are not. Well, so what the WIMPs do is that they run into the gold and knock a gold nucleus forward into the DNA. So let me just be clear, the WIMPs are not breaking the DNA, because if they did that, you'd be in trouble. But it's the gold that breaks the DNA. And then, thanks to biology, you can set this up so that these strands that fall down, that you know everything about them. So this would be A, C, G, the different bases of DNA. So you take the broken strand and you figure out where did this break happen, and you go, aha, I know where I am. And you can reconstruct a track that the gold took, which means you can reconstruct the track that the WIMP took, because it's more or less in the same direction. So this is these are wildly new ideas, and we hope to make them work. Okay, so so we had the idea of creating WIMPs in particle accelerators. So we had the idea of having your detector sitting there in a laboratory waiting to be hit by WIMPs. There's one third way that we call indirect detection. And so you remember I was talking about the annihilation of these particles are their own antimatter, so when they find each other, two dark matter particles, they annihilate. That doesn't mean they go away, that means they turn into something else. And in the process, what usually happens at the end, that they produce particles we can look for. So we can look for neutrinos, we can look for positrons, and the most interesting case is actually that we can look for gamma rays. These are high-energy photons, particles of light that are very energetic. And there's a Fermi, there's a satellite called Fermi that's looking for gamma rays. It's looking at the gamma ray sky, and it has. So it's looking for these products of the dark matter annihilation. And it has some interesting stuff going on towards the center of the galaxy. We expect the center of the galaxy to have a lot of dark matter. So here's what they see. This is the plane of the galaxy, where all the stars are. And then they find these giant bubbles of gamma rays, shown in purple here. So these things, this is 50,000 light years in extent. It's quite remarkable. And most of it's understood, but there's a central spherical part that is excessive, and that could be from dark matter annihilation. So there's a lot of thought and a lot of interest going into trying to understand, is that galactic center excess? Is that evidence for dark matter or not? So as far as putting together all the different pieces, well, we have this Dama, this direct detection, Dama annual modulation, and on the indirect detection, we have this Fermi galactic excess. So has dark matter been discovered? Well, what's going to happen is you're going to have compatible signals in a variety of experiments made of different detector materials, and all these very strong personalities will have to agree. So you have to get consensus going in order to figure out what's going on. So we're not there yet, but that's where we're headed. But while I'm at it, I have to talk to you about my latest baby, and that's dark stars. So this is potentially a fourth way to look for these for WIMPs. And here the idea is, again, it's the same annihilation you had in the early universe, or that you would be looking for in indirect detection. But it turns out that annihilation can be a power source for stars. So this the movie predated our use of dark stars. So this is it's the three of us, me, Doug Spoliar, and Paolo Gondolo, who had this idea. And I wasn't sure how much to talk about this, but I guess I'll answer questions. But the basic idea is the very first stars that formed, they were very, very dark matter rich. But just to be clear, they're stars. They're made almost entirely of hydrogen, a little bit of helium. And it doesn't take a lot of dark matter for the dark matter annihilation to be a potent source. So these very first stars, about 200 million years after the Big Bang, they could have been powered by dark matter annihilation, and they could have grown to be very big and bright. They could even be as big as a million times the mass of the sun, or in a billion times as bright. And the thing that I find really exciting is that they could show up in the next version of the Hubble Space Telescope. It's called the James Webb Space Telescope, and it's going to be launched in 2018, and I'm rooting for them to find dark stars. So, I could go on and on about dark stars, as you can tell. They could also be the origin, when they die, they turn into big black holes, and they could be the origin of the supermassive black holes that you see everywhere in the universe at the centers of galaxies and so on. But so putting it all together, we're doing WIMP hunting, and good chance of detection within this decade. So, as far as the pie chart of the universe, I've talked pretty much about the dark matter, and I haven't said much about the elephant sitting there, this is the 70% dark energy. And the reason I haven't done that is because it's a really, really, really difficult problem. So we know it exists, but figuring out what it is a whole different story. With dark matter, we have a lot of understanding and a good idea of how to look for it. Dark energy is really a theoretical conundrum. People are really, to some extent, lost. And since I don't have a whole lot of time, I'm not going to talk much about it. I'm just going to tell a joke. So this was at the World Science Festival in 2011. That's me, Elena Aprile, the leader of the Xenon experiment, Glenys Ferrar, and the three of us. It was our role to talk about dark matter. And these three guys were talking about dark energy. That's Mike Turner, Saul Perlmutter, he won the Nobel Prize for discovery of dark energy, and Brian Greene, a wonderful science writer. He wrote The Elegant Universe, among other books. And so on this panel, so we were talking about dark matter, they were talking about dark energy, and I had one true statement to make. So that's about all we know about dark energy, okay? So dark matter, we know it's attractive, it makes galaxies and so on. Dark energy, on the other hand, is causing our universe to accelerate. So all those galaxies are not just expanding apart, they're accelerating apart. That's about all we know about it. So this is a pretty accurate statement. So I just wanted to end with a few words about, so why did I write this book? So first of all, I just wanted to talk about the science of dark matter because I think it's one of those big questions people have always asked, like, what's out there? Human beings want to know. So the fact that we're kind of getting close to resolving this is a big deal. And then I also wanted to talk about the fun of doing science, the experience. So it's a bit of a memoir, the experiences of some of the personalities and the fun that we've had in doing science, collaborations. And then I also, while I was at it, I realized, wow, there are a lot of women leaders in this business, and so I'm hoping that for young people, that especially young women, this might be inspiring to realize if they can do it, we can do it. So that was kind of my goal in writing the book. So at that point, I want to thank you, and that's the end of my talk.
Great question. Terrific. Well, we'll open the floor to questions, and the microphone is right here. You can just make your way down, and we also can go to the online crew. But let's start with an in-house question. Aiden, you're up.
So, why does everyone seem to be convinced that it's a very massive particle? Couldn't it also be a boson that has a very powerful field that pulls stuff into it?
Well, people have investigated every kind of particle that we, all the particles that we know of. And so we really want something that doesn't have electromagnetic interactions, doesn't have strong interactions, and preferably is motivated by other theories. So that's why we've looked at the particular candidates that we've done.
All right, let's go to the online audience. And this is a question from @TheSteveHayden. Will LIGO and other similar detectors be of use in the detection or discovery of dark matter?
Other detectors, other things, yes. LIGO, probably not. LIGO is looking for gravitational waves, which are very, very weak signals that had been predicted by Einstein already back in 1915 or so. And you need to have something really drastic happen to be able to observe these very weak signals. So right now, the kinds of signals that we've seen are black holes that weigh about 30 times as much as the sun, two of them that collide together, and the amount of energy you get out of that is enough to produce gravity waves that the LIGO experiment was able to see it. So that was kind of the goal of LIGO, is to look for these gravity waves. And so this is probably not going to help so much with the dark matter question, but it is certainly going to open up a whole new window on the universe. So we already had, we can look for gamma rays, we can look for all different wavelengths of light, and we have different windows into the universe, infrared light, visible light, and gravity waves are a whole new window into the universe, but I don't think they're going to help with the dark matter problem.
Thank you. Let's go in studio.
Hi. The Higgs boson appears to be a rather nebulous piece of whatever you might call it, a nebulous particle, and you said it only exists for 10 to the minus 22nd seconds. And so what kind of stopwatch and do you need to measure that? And
what kind of what?
Stopwatch. And who's pressing the button? I mean, what kind of apparatus can measure something that only exists for 10 to the minus 22 seconds? And how do you know it's, in fact, doing that?
So a lot of particles are unstable, in fact, most of them. So the reason we're made of protons is because everything else decays until you get something that's long-lived. So protons, they're very long-lived. People look for their decay, but they're very long-lived, and that's why we're made of them. But so all kinds of things have these short lifetimes. There's nothing abnormal about that. But as far as detecting them, what you have to do is when you shot these two protons together, then that initial Higgs that almost immediately decays, if you understood the theory, you would know exactly what it would decay into, and then that would decay further, and so on. And you would know, theoretically, that entire chain. So you build these like concentric cylinders of detector material, and so you measure, okay, what's the first stage, and then the next stage, and the next stage. So you watch all these different pieces of the stuff that came out of that initial decay, you piece it back together to decide, yep, it's exactly what I predicted when I thought that I might have made a Higgs.
Thank you. Okay, let's go two more questions and we'll go to the online audience for this. First, let's go to @QuantumWave, and the question is this: will dark matter lead to or help lead to the grand unification?
Okay, so it depends what it's made of. Will dark matter lead to grand unification? So for example, what do we mean by grand unification? So as you go back in the history of the universe, forces unify when you get to higher energies. So right now, the electromagnetism and the weak force are separate entities. But if you go up to higher temperatures in the early universe, they were one force. And we do know that. We test that in particle accelerators. We know how that works. But what about bringing in the strong interactions? Now, that would be a grand unified theory. And so there are some, so you can sort of extrapolate, because we don't have enough energy in the accelerators to reproduce grand unified transitions. But in order for that unification to happen, you would have to have supersymmetry. And so supersymmetry is exactly the kind of thing that would give you WIMPs. So I guess what I'm saying is all these pieces work together, because the same supersymmetry that gave you dark matter also gives you grand unification. In fact, we don't know how to get grand unification to work without it. So you remember I was saying that you need the dark, that WIMPs have many motivations. Well, grand unification is actually one of them.
Oh, thank you. All right, and let's finish with a question from @GirlsExperimentPhysics. Do you have any words of advice for young women interested in a career in physics? All you.
I think the main one is, if you're asking this question, that means you're excited about it, you have passion for it, which I think innately most human beings do, because these are really cool questions. And so the main thing I would say is, and nowadays, of course, girls are testing at math the way they should have all along. They're, go girls. But when you get to college, don't get discouraged, because there is still some psychology out there of people trying to tell you you can't do that, or less directly, more like insecure male students acting like they know everything, and then you might think, oh, I don't, but they're just being insecure. So don't let anyone convince you you can't do it. Keep going. If you love it, keep doing it.
What a great way to finish. Thank you.